Welcome to the Rails with Jason podcast. I hope you enjoy this episode with Robbie Russell. Quick note before the episode starts, we had some audio issues with this episode that couldn't really be fixed. There was some chop due to a bad internet connection. So I just want you to know that I know that those are there, but there's only a few of them, so it's not too bad. Anyway, enjoy the show. Hey, today my guest is Robbie Russell, CEO of Planet Argon. Robbie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
So Robbie, you're known for a couple of things. I know you first and foremost for Zshell, and then also I know you have a podcast called the Maintainable Software Podcast. Do you want to tell us a little bit about both those things? And if you want to, just generally tell us about yourself.
Sure. So let's, you know, so in terms of the Zshell topic, just for a quick moment, I created a little tool, I guess it'd be 11 years ago this month, called Oh My Zshell, and that's a framework for managing your Zshell configuration, I think, at a really simplistic level. But it's got a bunch of plugins for, like, you know, for example, plugins for using things in for Ruby on Rails and Bundler, and there's ways to control your Spotify from it, or you can, so things that you can make your terminal, like a lot of shortcuts for Git and things like that. There's a couple hundred plugins that come included with the project. And then the other thing that people know it for is just having a kind of customizable theme interface. So in terms of making your command line interface look and represent you, however that is. And so I think it's fun colors, things like that nature, but something created, you know, quite a while ago. And it's grown in usage way beyond that what I ever thought would happen with it. But I'm glad to know that it's useful for people. And now I get to sell stickers and T-shirts and coffee mugs and stuff like that to people as I'm holding one up with my webcam over here to Jason. But which coincidentally is why I started programming in the first place.
Because of me? Because of you.
No, because of, I wanted to sell stickers on the internet in the late 90s. And so I'm like, how do I make like a way for people to submit an order? And that was like my first programming challenge, like that I really did much, like actually in a production sense, so I can sell stickers. And now because of some, I didn't really sell that many stickers. I probably sold a couple dozen back then. But now fast forward, you know, 23 years, due to some code that I wrote, I sell stickers. So finally, I'm selling stickers on the internet successfully, because that's not what happened back then. So that's a little bit about Oh My Zshell at a really, really high level. In terms of my podcast in particular, Maintainable, my goal with that has been to have conversations with people about who are kind of dealing with the messy aspects of software development. Projects, you know, application tends, you know, they tend to live for a while. And there's a lot of conversations happening on the internet about new technology, you know, what's new in Rails 6.1 or some new frameworks, and people, like, a lot of conversations related to that. And I got out of my own curiosity, really want to have more conversations with people that are dealing with code bases that are 10, 15 years old, trying to navigate how to, like, keep those things updated and getting dependencies updated and just dealing with the politics and the personnel problems that come related and the baggage that comes with software projects that aren't necessarily solved by just willing it away with some refactoring code. So a lot of that podcast topics relate to just like a lot of the human elements and the challenges that people have, or when you jump into a project and you're inheriting a project, and how do you navigate that environment and help make things better than they were when you found it, and just trying to find some way to help just have this conversation around people that most software has some messy aspects to it. And I want to just have those uncomfortable conversations and see if there's some ways to kind of help breathe life into those older applications, rather than just as a mission, I'm trying to help fight the big rewrite as best I can. And I feel like that's one way that I can kind of help do that in the community.
Yeah. Well, that might be a good thing for us to talk about. By the way, dear listener, me and Robbie are just completely winging it. We just hit record and said YOLO without having a plan, which I think is good. But for a topic, I think like what you just said is great, because that's something that I've thought about a lot. I've worked with a lot of legacy code in my career. And maybe let's dig into a couple of those things. So I think you had a really good point bringing up all of those surrounding forces, because something that I always say is like, if you're working on a project and the code is really low quality, that code didn't write itself. That code got the way it did through some processes. And the quality of the code is probably a reflection of the quality of the way that that organization writes code. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think there's always an interesting parallel to the organization, the team, the communication ability between whether the software developers and the product owners and other departments that might have influence in how a particular application is being built. I mean, there's plenty of stories about how, you know, and I think a good conversation also to have in the space is just whether when you're building, we're working in a startup environment where you haven't even launched the application yet, and there could be a lot of, there could be a good conversation to have about just how much is too much optimization early on in your software development process when you're just trying to figure out if you have a good product market fit. And so I think sometimes there's a lot of projects that will, they'll be running really fast because they need to get this thing shipped to see if they can get some customers or make sure this is going to work in the marketplace. Because you never know if that project is going to survive a year or two from now. I worked on a lot of projects early on in my career where our team would be working 6, 9, 12 months on a project, ship it, and then 2 years later, like that company's just completely out of business and like that code doesn't do anything anymore at that point. And immediately, like, and so that was always a little bit of a difficult thing, but we didn't blame it on the code necessarily. It's like, well, they didn't know how to sell that specific product. They had a hypothesis for a product and it just didn't, they didn't land it. And so that happens. But there's a lot of other stories about the projects that do make it through that process. And there's always this conversation about like, one day we'll come back and do this, clean this stuff up. But the reality is once you start hitting that product market fit aspect of your application and your business model, you know, now you're getting customers that are asking for new things and you kind of just keep tacking on things and making work and you have to pivot a few times because your business model changes, you know,
thing that I hear is like, oh, we'll just fix that when things slow down, when we have more time. And it's like, no, I got news for you. Things are never going to slow down. Things are going to get more and more urgent forever. Unless the business like implodes, like any successful business, the needs are going to be more and more urgent all the time.
It's true. The there's that. Does someday ever really happen? Is, you know, it's like, is there a someday maybe we can take care of this? And then you have all these problems. So they just kind of keep tacking on over time. And then, you know, find yourself 5, 7, 10 years later down the road, and you're like, you have a much larger development team. And some of those maybe things you, those corners you took early on for maybe that helped you get to market earlier, potentially, but you haven't been able to really go back and address those things. And that could be a challenge for teams to figure out doing that. And so people that come in are like, well, this is how, these are the patterns I'm following, because you tend to mimic what's already being done in an application quite often, depending on like how your team, you know, if there's like, well, we have to go in this area of code and this is what the previous people did, so I'll kind of just follow kind of a consistent pattern, so at least it kind of makes sense. Or depending on the quality of their test suite or a bunch of other reasons that will might make people feel nervous to like start drastically deviating from the way things have, you know, I'm air quoting, always been done on this project. But that is a common thing. And so then you get this problem that you, like, how do you start improving things at that point in time? So, or in the future. So I don't know. I enjoy having those kind of conversations, but on the humans outside of even just on the technical level, you know, as your team grows, or, you know, sometimes the people that are originally around on a project are not there anymore. And so you lose some of that context for why things are the way they are. And I also think it's important for developers to just make an assumption that the people that previously worked on the project, even if they're there or not, even if it's yourself, did the best that they could with the information and time and capacity they had at the time and their skill set at that time. So if you just kind of forgive the former people a little bit before you start critiquing things, but just knowing, like, how do we start moving forward and making, you know, moving the needle or steering the ship a little bit more in the right direction for better long-term health of this application.
Mm-hmm. Being the cynical asshole that I am, I don't always give people that much credit. Sometimes I think the reason people do poor work is because they have this fallacious belief that they're going to win by sacrificing quality in order to get speed. And they think, you know, users don't care about code. We need to work quickly in order to get to market as fast as possible. And sacrificing quality is the way to get there, and we can clean it up later. And that's why they do the poor work in a lot of cases, I think. Mm. And that's, it's also forgivable. But I think it's an important distinction to make, because I really hope that we can educate people out of that mistaken belief that you win by cutting those corners, because in my opinion, you totally don't.
That's fair. And maybe another thing that I've, you know, thought about and spoken with people on my podcast too, is just that, let's say early on in a project, there's probably not a lot of people working on that early aspect of the code base, right? It might be a small team. Maybe it's even one or two developers that are kind of like that core initial group. So when they're shipping things and they're, how is that organization rewarding and those developers? You know, it's like, what are they showing that they have value? Where's the value there? Is that you, as a developer, you ship code that has a lot of good tests? Like, the product owners, they expect you to test the code, right? However you do it is like a, I don't know, you figure that out. But give me working code is like, I think what the product part of that equation is looking for. And so they probably praise the developers when they ship stuff. Like, yay, great, we got this thing. Oh, quick, you quickly fixed this bug. But did they go through and refactor things to make it less likely that something like that might happen in the future? Who knows? So sometimes the organization as a whole, it starts to reinforce this sort of pattern of recognition for how they're, you know, and you end up creating these scenarios where you have someone that's like, that gets that, those endorphin rushes when they deliver something and their client or stakeholders are happy about it. Like, cool, that's the thing that this organization values in me, is shipping quickly.
Yeah, that's tough. Yeah, that's tough, because it's very tempting and it's very difficult to like swim upstream against that. Because if I know, I've been guilty of this even within the last week, if I know that I can ship something in 5 minutes and get a pat on the back for it and feel good, or I can take 4 hours and do a good job and write tests and all that stuff, but then it's a much longer time before I get that praise and it doesn't look like I'm shipping as fast or working as hard or whatever, then it's very tempting to just do the 5 minute thing. But that's, of course, when people need to be a grown up and a professional and say, even though there's this very strong temptation and maybe a lot of explicit pressure to like not do things quote unquote the right way and just get it done and get it out there, I need to do what I know is the better way to do it instead.
It's like can't just go around with a bunch of duct tape necessarily, you know, in your application, knowing that from the outside, no one sees all the duct tape, but it's there. It's messy.
They don't see the duct tape itself. It's just down the road, they start to see the evidence of the duct tape. Yeah. And unfortunately, by the time you start to see the evidence of the duct tape, it's often too late to like turn things around without a huge expense.
There's that. I also think that because of that, there's this other problem that happens down the road as you start to see these expenses, and then the product side of the equation is like, why are things taking so much longer now? And they're like, well, we had to cut all these corners back then, we have all this mess. And then it kind of becomes like the surprise, it's illuminating, like, oh shit, how did we get here? Like, you're the one that produced the code. Why did you write code that you're not happy with in retrospect? Or how did you test this? And like, what do you mean? What's this automated test thing? Like, those are, ends up being this thing where you've kind of like broken some level of trust where the people are like, well, I thought you were taking care of all that stuff so that we wouldn't have this problem. So it becomes your problem no matter what anyways. So then you have to go in that position of like, now I got to sell the business on investing in making things better, when the business didn't feel like they were probably investing in making a mess. They were like, you know, so it's like this, like, what do you mean? What did you, what do you mean? We've been racking up debt all this time. And
yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. And let's maybe go deeper into this particular thing for a second. Like, if we think about the details of this, like, who are the developers normally in the organization? They developers skew younger, because for whatever reason, when developers get older, they often like stop being developers. So like, there's these people who are maybe in their early mid 20s or whatever. And then there's the bosses, whether that's the owner of the company or some kind of project manager, VP, that person is going to be like more senior in the organization, as well as just like an older, more experienced person. And also like, those people are going to be like more of like the salesy type people who are like really smooth and good at talking and good at like formulating their arguments into words and stuff like that and being persuasive, where, you know, unfortunately us geeks don't always have those skills. And so in those clashes where the higher ups are putting pressure on the developers and trying to tell the developers how to do their jobs, like sometimes specifically saying, don't write tests because that's a waste of time, something like that. It's really hard for the developers not to capitulate to that pressure and do the job in that lower grade way that they're being pressured to do. But then when things finally turn to shit, like 6 or 12 months later or whatever, who gets blamed? Like, does the CEO say, oh crap, you know, I'm sorry guys, that was my fault. I shouldn't have told you to cut those corners. So now I'm going to give you a bunch of time to go and fix everything. No, that never happens. You're going to get the blame at that time, most likely. So at that earlier stage where you're getting the pressure to cut corners, even though it's really difficult, you have to not succumb to that pressure.
A thing that I'm always curious about is like thinking whether that conversation happens of like, how does it, depending on that, the CEO or whoever the decision maker is, does that conversation happen a lot where they're the ones deciding that you don't need to write automated tests? Or is it that developers are coming to those people saying, well, with some extra time, I can also write some tests. Can I get the time to do the thing and make sure it works for the future? And it seems like an additional extra add-on thing. I wonder if you said, hey, this is going to take me 3 days or 4 days to deliver. What does it mean to deliver? Is the testing a separate deliverable? Yeah. No, it should just be probably the same. It's the task. Like, how do you know that this code that you produce works? Well, so I tested it.
Yeah. 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 There's this viewpoint that really pisses me off, which is sometimes developers think that the right thing to do when they get like an urgent task is to go to their boss and say, well, boss, I can do this method A where it'll take me 3 weeks and I'm going to write tests and do high quality and stuff like that. Or we can cut some corners and incur some technical debt and stuff like that, and we can get it done in 3 days. So that's my assessment. My recommendation is that we do method A and not method B. But since you're the business person, this is a business decision. I'm going to leave that to you to make that decision. And obviously, 99 times out of 100, they're going to pick the faster option. And so that's not the right way. That's not being responsible. That's not being a professional. That's just a wrong belief. What you need to do is recognize what is like on their side of the fence and what's on your side of the fence and what is your responsibility and what's theirs, and say like, no, I'm going to do this in the way that I know is a good way, and I'm not going to do it in a stupid bad way just because somebody else wanted me to. And to have the guts, and I know not everybody can be in this position, so like, but like, to have the guts to be like, maybe I'm going to get fired for behaving in this way, but I'm not going to like do my job in a stupid way for my whole career just because of that. And, you know, most times you're not going to get fired for making that kind of stuff. But that's my take on that.
And, you know, I would imagine that those more senior people in the organization, those, you know, quote unquote decision makers, you know damn well that they're taking some sort of, part of their job is to manage risk for their area of the business. And there's probably things that they're doing that they don't feel like they need to double check with their superior, like the superiors are usually expecting them, like, do provide quality work, right? Obviously, why would we want anyone to produce non-quality work? And I feel like that's the conversation people are having. It's like, well, it's this extra thing we may or may not need. You just say, like, in order for me to deliver it, it's going to take this much time, period. You know, there's like, that is, this is this way. If you want to get something done faster, we need to cut the scope. Or what's a shorter version of whatever you're asking for? That should be the conversation, not, well, I can cut off some of the protection mechanisms for managing a risk in the application. Nobody's going to want to, like, pick that as the thing. I like to think, and I'm not saying that there's not people that are like, yeah, that doesn't matter right now. But unless you have like a manager or, you know, stakeholder that maybe comes from a software development pattern background, and they're like, well, I didn't write tasks back in the day, so I don't know how valuable those are. So that could be maybe a different type of tricky conversation, but I think it's just a matter of, like, how do you know that what you're working on works? Like, you're testing somehow, you just can't consistently quickly reproduce it. So, and I would imagine nobody typically just writes code without checking that it runs properly somehow. So can you reproduce that? And that's what that is, just making, like, hey, it takes me time to do this manually. Wouldn't it be great if this could just do it in 30 seconds every time anyone makes a change in this application, to know that thing still works? Like, yeah, that sounds great. So I also wonder sometimes if it's another aspect that we may or may not want to admit, is that not every developer feels super competent in writing good tests or even knowing how to do it, because maybe they do or don't have people on their team that are embracing that or have embraced that. And so they don't really know who to kind of mimic that behavior of writing automated tests. And there's books out there, but those books and articles you read are usually about kind of maybe simpler scenarios and examples of how to write tests. And so until you really get to do a lot of it, then you don't really pick up on that skill set sometimes. So it becomes like putting it into practice can be a little bit of a challenge too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is actually kind of among the more valid excuses. It's much more forgivable for somebody to not write tests because they don't know how than to not write tests because they know how, but they're just being undisciplined. Mm. Yeah. And learning testing, admittedly, is hard. It took me a really long time to get it. The first tests that I wrote felt really pointless, and I think they actually, in reality, were pointless, but it took me a long time to figure out how to write tests that aren't pointless. So yeah, that whole thing is difficult.
There's also the, until you have those moments when your test suite protects you from something, it seems like there's like a, like, do these things have value? Like, how is this really, like, yeah, like everything we're working on, things, the test suite's consistently passing. Great. How often does that scenario, like, oh shit, things almost blew up because someone pushed something and it broke the build drastically. If this had gone to production, this would have been a nightmare. So that protected me from that scenario. I think sometimes early on in people's careers, they don't have that experience yet. So they're like, what am I doing? Okay, I just keep doing this. Okay. All right. So this is helping me on this specific ticket that I'm working on, or this feature or whatever, but I don't really understand, like, the big picture, how this is going to save my bottom one day. But
yeah, that's an interesting thing. Probably a good way for a beginner to learn about testing is, like, to start with something where there's a really tight feedback loop, because testing can pay off in the long run, but testing can also pay off in the super short run, like even the same day or the same hour. Because, like, if you're writing a method that has, like, a lot of different permutations of inputs and outputs, then you could have and let's say this is just, like, you're writing a Ruby class, no Rails, no web, no anything. It's just a Ruby class where there's a lot of different possible inputs and outputs. If you write tests for all those cases and there's, like, 15 cases and 15 different ways this thing could work, you're going to pay yourself back super fast by doing something like that. So I guess that would be my advice to anybody listening who doesn't quite grasp yet the value of testing. That would be a way to demonstrate it to yourself pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think that's some good advice there.
Yeah, so let's see. We were talking about legacy projects, how to turn them around, the factors that can contribute to legacy projects being the way they are. What can somebody do if they're working on a team and the project's code is low quality and they want to try to make things better? What would be your advice in that situation?
Are we talking about a scenario where someone's new into a team or they've been there for a while?
Oh, either way.
Okay. Well, I think it's interesting because I think when you've been embedded for a team for a while, you probably, like, is there anyone saying don't work on any cleanup? And that may or may not be the case. I think there's a lot of different ways and patterns that people use to, like, let's just take technical debt as like a general term for things that need some polishing or improve the quality of the code or making it more readable, easier to maintain and just work off of, you know, iterate on and is important, or making sure that you're introducing some testing into the environment if that's not been kind of the practice of all the developers that have been there to date. But I think, you know, when you're starting, you're like, okay, I'm going to start making a difference today. You know, so if you're listening and you're like, okay, well, maybe I've complained to the stakeholders, like, hey, this is a mess. And they've said, well, let's take care of that some other day. Like, are there things you can start doing today and to start cleaning some stuff up? And that's, I don't know that you always need to have as much permission. You could, I'm not saying just go completely rogue and just ignore all of your commitments you've made on projects, or if you're working in a sprint, like what you're supposed to be delivering. But every time you start working on some code, there's nothing preventing you from thinking, okay, well, here's, if I can spend another 15 minutes in this area and refactor something to make it a little bit more easier to understand for the next person or myself to comprehend what's going on here, do that. You don't always need to ask for permission. You know, it's like the whole, you can ask for forgiveness is easier than asking for permission thing. And so I think it's just like, and another aspect, if you start making, so to provide some context, you know, I work in the consulting side of things. And so I run an agency and we're usually working on another team's code base or a project we've inherited from other teams. We may or may not have access to the previous developers. I would say 70% of the time we don't. We inherit a project from another agency or some freelancers, and it kind of comes into our lap at some point to continue pushing it forward. And so we're sometimes lacking that context. And so, but I've worked with people that had people on teams where, you know, we might come in and be like, hey, we want to, like, even like the README file for this application isn't up to date. And so sending a pull request early on for like, hey, we're going to clean this. While trying to get this application running, we had some problems and the documentation doesn't seem like it's been updated in a while. We can submit a pull request for that. But there has been times when we've been invited to come into a project with another team where just trying to, like, oh, we found some weird issues that are slowing the test down. And we're like, we send a pull request for some things that weren't on the feature that they were hoping us to work on, but it's kind of related. It makes our life a little bit better. And there has been those scenarios where we get pushback from like the client side developers, but like, don't worry about that. You know, that's what I've been telling my team. Like, we're going to take care of that some other day. That's not important. And you're just kind of like, but this is already impeding me from being productive on your project. And I'm a new person, so I already did the work. Can you review the pull request? And, you know, we can move on from this conversation. But so sometimes sometimes it's the developers that are discouraging other developers from making things better for themselves. And that's
yeah. Yeah. And that's tough. Cause in those situations, you can try to make a pitch and persuade, and sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. I think sadly, usually it doesn't. And if it doesn't, there's not much you can do, and it's probably best just to accept it and grin and bear it rather than try to beat a dead horse and, you know, quietly put in job applications elsewhere during that time. But the other case is that everybody is on your side. And luckily, well, I don't know. I don't know if that's been the case for me most of the time or half the time or what, but it's been the case for me at least some of the time, where often when the code is bad, everybody knows it and nobody's happy about it. Sure. And everybody, including often the stakeholders, want things to improve. Those are better situations, obviously. I've had some little bit of success before, like getting the team together and being like, okay, what do we identify as the biggest problems with our code base? And like, where do we want to be like 6 months from now, maybe? Or can we like think of some areas we want to improve? Because you can't really get from point A to point B with the code if you haven't decided together where point B is. Mm. And so that's a helpful thing to do. But in that scenario where everybody is on of the same opinion that you want to make things better, have you had any tactics that have been successful for you in the past?
I think, you know, I like that point you made about when you have to kind of connect A and B, or the team needs to have a shared vision, right? For like, where are we working towards? And I do think there's some strategies. One, trying to, especially if you're coming into a new environment and you don't need to have to, like a not so effective question to ask your peers is, why was this written this way? And looking to find blame, maybe, or to point a finger, whether it's at yourself or someone else or someone that's no longer there, especially,
hey, why did you guys write such stupid, shitty code?
Yeah. And like that, it's just not a super helpful, you know, conversation to go down. Like, what were you thinking here? You just trying to go back to the whole, let's just assume the best of intentions by most people on the project. And how do we get to where we want to go is like a more interesting conversation, I think, to have. And like, what do we need to do to get there? And what are some things, you know, like in 6 months, would we all feel really great about the idea if we had a running test suite? You know, yes. Yeah. Everybody, I think most people would be like, yeah, that sounds great. Well, how do we start moving there? It's like, well, maybe your application doesn't have much or any automated testing at this point, which is its own problem. But like, there's nothing, I mean, it's going to take a little bit of work to start introducing that first test. And like, okay, well, you can't shoot for like 100% coverage from the beginning, you know? So it's like, how can we start incrementally changing our behavior as a team? And that's this is like another thing that comes up outside of even just like testing or just like improving the quality code, is just keeping your application up to date on the versions, whether that be dependencies or the base version of Ruby on Rails. You know, there's a lot of conversations, or I say conversation, but there's people out there talking about like, oh, we need to stay up on the latest version, but then, well, the product owners, you know, they didn't want to prioritize going from Rails 3 to 4, 4 to 5 or whatever, 5 to 6 now, or 6.1. And so it was like a decision someone else made to not do that. But then, you know, then we get calls from companies where they're like, hey, we've got 30, 40 developers on this team, and we just don't know how the hell we're ever going to get this thing upgraded because everybody's too busy working on the product backlog. Can you come in and do that for us? And we've done that a lot over the years, but I've been growing increasingly concerned about that because I don't feel like the team's figuring out how to just make that part of their responsibility of keeping the code up to date as well. Like, they just don't have the practices or it's not so much a skill set as much of just consistency on like, when do we take care of it? Who is responsible for like, hey, there's a new version of something. Do we need to patch this? Or, I know there's a lot of cool like tools out there now that will help with like some dependency to show that there's new versions of a dependency that your app relies on. It might send you a pull request automatically and show you if the test suite's green still. And that's great, but not everybody has a reliable test suite to know if that's, so they're a little nervous about like, I'm not going to just click on a merge from a bot, you know, for that all the time because it don't have confidence in the rest of the pipeline there. So so when companies come to us nowadays and they're like, hey, can we outsource the upgrade to you and you can just kind of pass it back over to us when you're ready? We're like, well, the reality is you're going to need people to help on your end that are going to be heavily involved in the upgrade process. If at anything, to answer tons and tons of questions of our team, because we don't understand your domain and your business. We know how to work on Rails apps. We can help you, you know, get the thing upgraded. But there's going to be some points where we need to work together. So I think teams often underestimate how much they're going to need to be involved in that. And then that becomes a frustrating point for the, like for us as for having a client being like, why is the upgrade taking so much more time? Or why do you need so much of my own team's time? I'm like, it's not an independent activity. It's, we're still having to interact with the domain of your application. And you have domain experts on your team who are also busy working on those new features. And so you're trying to like in parallel, increase the version or improve, upgrade your application while also taking care of it day to day and making sure that can all coexist. And so one of the things we've been trying to advocate for is like, don't outsource your upgrade but maybe find a team like ours, or, you know, that can help your team build that discipline into their own process. And we can help you kind of get that first bump up there, but you really need your team to build that into their workflow. Be like, yeah. Who's responsible for this? How are we going to do it? How frequently? Is this a quarterly thing? I think there's just always like, oh, maybe in the next slow season, we'll have time to do an upgrade. And then that never comes. And it's 2 or 3 years later. And you're like, oh shit, we're way farther behind now. And that's comes with its own set of challenges when you're onboarding new people and stuff to your project. And they're like, why are we still running on Rails 4? You know, whatever. And it's like, well, we haven't had time. And it's like, well, now you have this really big backlog of things you need to take care of. And it's a scary proposition to now start diving into an upgrade. Because I know I talk to most companies and there's usually someone there that's like, oh, go create a new branch to start spinning up a new version. I'm going to go update the gem versions of Rails and like, let's see what happens. Like, let me see if I can do this really quickly. They get a day or two into it and they're like, oh boy, this is a huge rat's nest. There's so many things we're going to have to refactor and deal with all of a sudden. The test suite's completely blowing up and I don't even know where to begin to deal with 1,000, you know, failing tests all of a sudden. I'll have to come back to this another day. Go back to your other branch and then move on with your product backlog. And then that stuff happens so often, I think, within teams. If there's someone that has the motivation to do it, but they're not able to see it through. And then the team doesn't really know how to like adapt to that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I guess like in some ways outsourcing your Rails upgrade is kind of like getting liposuction or something. It's like, yeah, you used to be fat and now you're skinny, but you're probably just going to get fat again because you haven't like adopted good eating and exercise habits and stuff like that. And so if somebody outsources their Rails upgrade, they're just going to have the same problem down the road at some point, potentially.
Your team needs to be able to figure that out. And so, and there's ways to help teams like that improve upon that. So, cause otherwise, you know, you get that there's always going to, at some point there's going to be the great merge, right? And that's depending on how your QA process works and like how you roll things out, like does your deployment pipelines all of a sudden changing because of this? Do you need to run both versions in parallel and kind of cascade this out across all of your servers or however you're deploying things? Like, there's a lot of other challenges that your team needs to be heavily involved in. And I don't think that's something you can just exclusively outsource. I know that there's a lot of success with that and we've worked on upgrades, but I just don't think it's adding the same sort of value to the internal development team as I think is that relationship should be. Like if my team gets brought in to help with an upgrade, I want it to be the very last team you ever need to help you with the upgrade because your team can take care of this stuff going forward. It's good money for us, I think, but it's, to kind of put myself out of a job there, but I want us to be working on more interesting projects than necessarily just, you know, dealing with the dependency problems with an upgrade and stuff like that as well.
Well, it's one thing to have a service outsourced and it's another thing to be able to do an actual skill transfer, which is much, much more valuable a lot of time, unless they want to just keep outsourcing that over and over, which is maybe a valid way to go. I don't know. I had a question for you, which is a completely unrelated question to this topic, but it goes back to something we were talking about earlier with testing. What percentage, even just a super rough guess, would you say of projects that you inherit have decent test coverage? Or I guess there's maybe like three things. Like there's projects with no test coverage at all. There's projects with excellent test coverage. And then there's projects that are like, maybe kind of okay. What do you tend to see?
More so, I would say 70% of the projects have very little tests in there, or there's tests that were there maybe early on in the project. It's like you look at the test or the spec directory on an application, like even just looking at it on GitHub or something, you can see, oh, this no one's touched the spec directory in 2 years, 3 years. Like that's really common, especially with projects that had very few developers on it, or maybe in parallel, I should say. There's a lot of projects that where you see that there's been 10, 15 different developers over the lifespan that have worked on it, but maybe in the last few years, it's been 1-2 people that have worked on it. And so for whatever reason, they're just like, well, it's just easier for me to just manually test this, I guess. And then, or And so they kind of neglect the test suite. There's usually a lot of, more often than not, the test suite is broken when it comes our way. So I would say maybe 20% of the time there's like really good test coverage where I'd say it's probably in the 70, 80 plus percentile, but that might even be a little bit of an exaggeration. So,
yeah, I started a job once and I was getting everything set up on my machine. And I had trouble getting the test suite to run. And after spending a while on it, I went to my boss. I'm like, hey, for whatever reason, I just can't get the test suite to run on my machine. And he's like, oh, the tests don't run. They don't actually pass. I'm like, oh, got it. I think like I have caught sentiments here and there of like, isn't it like just de rigueur at this point? Like, doesn't everybody write tests for everything? But like, no, like a good slice of developers either write no tests or very little tests. And I'm not saying that to like chastise anybody for that or anything like that. But it's just kind of interesting to look at the landscape and see where we are at this point in time. When I first started programming, the 90s, nobody I knew was doing testing. And it wasn't until after 2010 that I started doing any serious testing, or that I like started encountering anybody else who was doing testing. And yeah, it's still pretty rare to come across a project where the test coverage is actually pretty good.
And that's true. The coincidentally, we're about to release the 2020 Ruby on Rails community survey results, and so I'm just pulling up some of those numbers. Okay, but like one of the questions we ask people is, "What is your code to test spec ratio? What does your team aim for with regards to that?" And let's see, 45% of the people that responded said 80 to 100% test coverage. And then, so it's like more often than not, most teams aim for that, but then is that actually happening or is it just like that's their wishful thinking or their target at some point, maybe to get to that point? So,
And how many people chose not to respond out of shame?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't have that data point in front of me, but it's interesting. It's also interesting that 7% said 1 to 20% is what they aim for. Like, that's why I set the bar so low.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Okay. Well, where to go from here? We're getting close to time, so maybe one or two more questions or topics before we wrap it up. One thing that I wanted to ask you about, can you tell me about, and this is completely off topic, can you tell me about your band?
Oh, yeah. So I'm a guitarist and I play in a post-rock, which is, we're an instrumental rock band essentially. And so it's called The Mighty Missoula, and you can find us on Spotify and everything, tools or different streaming services like that. Or you can also be kind and go to Bandcamp and purchase our vinyl record that we released in April. We were supposed to have our album release show, obviously, and due to COVID, I don't know when I'll ever play a live show again. So I've got the band has a big box of vinyl records, and we would love to have you buy one. But beyond that, we create instrument. It's instrumental rock music, and my goal is always, I always wanted to make music that would be good soundtrack type music, whether that be something to code to or something, you know, like my little wishful, the height of celebrityism, I think, with like my peak of success, I should say, with being a musician, would be nice for like 15 seconds in the backdrop of a movie or a commercial to hear something that I helped create play in the background.
It doesn't say anything. 28 Days Later.
Yes, exactly.
Godspeed You Black Emperor did like the music. I don't know if you'd consider them a post-rock band or not.
I do. Yeah. They're definitely, so it's in that realm. We're kind of inspired by Godspeed You Black Emperor, Mogwai, you know, Explosions in the Sky.
This will destroy your type bands. Explosions in the Sky, yeah.
So it's in that realm. And a lot of our, you know, without, we don't have any lyrics or anything, but back to the whole just being kind of background music to some degree. But the, you know, it's an interesting, it's funny because I had a band in the early 2000s where we were an instrumental band as well. And then I think it kind of, and then So, you know, about 3 or 4 years, I guess it's probably been longer now, about 5 years ago, I was like looking at my music equipment in the corner being like, I don't use it that much anymore. And I realized one of the things I missed about playing music. I mean, I would play by myself and such every once in a while, but I really just missed collaborating with other people in real time. And so I was like, I wonder if I can, maybe I could start a band again. Maybe I'm not too old for that yet. And then I'm like, let me see what I can do. And over time was able to put together a band here in Portland, Oregon in the US. And with that kind of like, my vision was just like, I want to make instrumental music and I would love for it to show up in a soundtrack one day. That would just be amazing. But if I never get there, that's okay. But I also want to be able to play live shows because I do enjoy performing for people and it can be fun. So even if I'm not on stage singing at them, I suppose, but yeah, that's the Mighty Missoula. You can find us on online.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like the funnest thing in the world is playing live shows. I was in a band in high school and college called The Moms, and we last played in 2005, and then we took a break for 14 years, and then last year, 2019, we played a reunion show in my barn at my house, and that was awesome, and it like couldn't have been better timing, because it was like August 2019, and you know, little did we know, we only had a few more months before that like wasn't going to be possible at all anymore. So I'm glad that we, and honestly, that's probably the last time we'll ever play because everybody has like moved to different parts of the region and stuff like that.
That's great. I'm good. You know, what instrument do you play?
Mainly guitar.
Okay.
Yeah. Nice. I play guitar and I sing poorly. I have some stuff on SoundCloud. If you really want to, you can try to find it. I'm not going to give you the URL. Yeah, and then I was in a band. It was the band was called Man Candy, and we were a sadcore band, we called ourselves. And then some other stuff after that. I tried to put together a band recently, but like, I'm jealous of you for living in Portland because it certainly is much easier there than here in West Michigan, where there's just like not as much going on musically or anything like that. I put up a thing on Craigslist. Maybe you've had these awful Craigslist experiences before.
Oh my God,
like
of course.
I have. Yeah.
There's always, and it's funny because all of the members in my band I found through Craigslist, but it also meant wading through a lot of interesting replies on Craigslist. And it's a funny, actually, side story. This goes back to, I think, like 2002 or so. Actually, my business partner today, we worked at another company a long time together, back in the 2000, 2002, 3 era. And I was in a band and we were looking for a musician. I think it was a drummer. And little known I know that my coworker at the time, Gary, he replied to the ad, and we sat across for like cubicles from each other. And I was getting these weird conversations with someone. So I was having this weird back and forth conversation on Craigslist with someone who was just kind of weird. He was like, "Oh yeah, I'm a drummer. I'm interested in playing." And so I was like, "Oh cool, maybe we can schedule time for you to come audition with us." And then the conversation started getting really weird, where he's like, "Yeah, great. Well, I don't have like a vehicle. Could you help me move my drum kit to your practice space?" And I was like, "Okay, yeah, we can probably arrange that." and he's like, and then the conversation got a little weirder. And then it was like, "Well, so they're actually stored at my ex-girlfriend's house, and so I'm gonna need help. Like, well, can you pick me up? And we're gonna go to my ex-girlfriend's house to pick it up." I'm like, "Okay." And he's like, "Well, there's a good chance she won't be home. And so I might need to like go through the window and maybe you could," I was like, "Where is it?" And so meanwhile, I'm having this email back and forth with someone one day, like on my lunch break. And I'm like, and then I start talking to my coworker across cubicles. And I was like, "You won't believe what I'm dealing with. Like, this person is just, I think they want me to like help steal a drum kit from someone's house." I eventually just stopped responding to that person. And it wasn't until like 2 or 3 years later, he kind of casually mentioned that. He's like, "Oh, you know, I'm that person." He mentioned that the name, and I'm like, "Ah, it's you."
So that whole thing was like just to fuck with you.
He was like that, and so I appreciate that. So obviously, years later, when I started my own company and then realized I needed someone with more experience on the team, I invited him in to be one of my business partners here. So, so I've forgiven him for that, but it's a fun little story that he brings up every once in a while. And like, remember Herb Bunsen? I'm like,
yes, Herb Bunsen.
So,
that's a great name.
But yeah, I did find musicians on Craigslist. It's not a, you know, that's about the only thing I think I've looked for on Craigslist in a long time, but, surprisingly, that still is a way to do that. Yeah. And I don't know if it would still be as effective as it's been a couple of years since I last had to recruit someone. I think we had to find a drummer replacement maybe 2 years ago because our original drummer went to journalism school in Canada. And so we're like, oh, crap. Like, how are we going to ever find as good of a drummer? But we did. We found a good drummer. So I'm excited about
yeah.
that.
I kind of like love to hate the Craigslist ads that I go through. Like I read them and they're just so awful. And I just like savor their terribleness, you know, like the people who like, I want to bring rock back to its roots and stuff yeah. like that. It's like, no, I don't yeah. want to ever talk to you. This is horrible.
No, there's, well, it's interesting because when, you know, as a musician and a, how interested our audience is into this, but there's, it's an interesting, I really enjoy playing music. I don't know how to read music. I'm not like the most talented guitar player by any means. So I remember we were looking to bring in a second guitar player because in our recordings, I had some like second and third guitar layers. I'm like, how can we better fill out our live sound and then have someone new to help contribute to new music? And I was really intimidated by people that were replying to the ad, but I'm like, this person's going to be so good at the guitar that I'm like, I'm not going to have, I don't know where I'm, how I'm going to have a voice in the direction of the sound of the band and stuff like that. It was a really like weird thing for me to kind of get over, but I eventually did. But then one thing is I know that I'm not in this genre of music. There's a lot of people that really like to geek out about the, like your guitar pedal board. And I have a big board with a lot of pedals, but I don't enjoy geeking out about them in the same way that a lot of other people do. And there's a lot of people that are like kind of gear junkie type people where they're applying, you know, they're responding to your ad and like, are you interested in our music or are you just wanting to let me know that you've been able to acquire enough money to buy that level of equipment? Doesn't really tell me like what your interests are in music or how you write music. It just says like, oh, I'm a good musician because I've got this good equipment. But then I feel like that's like a weird, I see that happening sometimes even in like the technology like thing world as well. It's like, actually just recently I was looking for a designer to help out with a small project. We're going to find a freelancer and a number of people replied kind of just highlighting their advanced skills with Photoshop and tools like that. I'm like, I expect you to know how to use the tools, but it's like, what is it about this type of specific project you can help me with? And like the output of what those tools are. And like, they're like selling the tools as their way to be like, yeah, you should hire me. I have like 10 years of experience with Photoshop. And I'm like, that doesn't mean anything to me. It's the same way if you had 10 years of experience working with Ruby on Rails, but you've not been a good Ruby on Rails developer the whole time. That doesn't, you know, that's like it's a weird thing. Like what have you helped do? What have you helped promote or help release? And how did you make the applications better? How did you improve the test suite? Like, I don't see a lot of that on people's resumes. And I would like to see more of like their accomplishments with the tools, not that they work day in, day out with the tools themselves. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. People could really stand to educate themselves regarding like how to respond to a job ad. And yeah, like pitching how many years you have of such and such usually isn't very persuasive. Yeah. It's hard to find people to work with, hard to find people to play music with. Maybe we can talk about the music thing for just a minute longer and then wrap up for the four listeners who are still with us. I moved to Austin for a while. I actually moved there in large part to try to start a band because Austin was like the live music capital of the world or whatever they claimed. And I was having just such a hard time finding people. And I did the Craigslist thing. And it was like, you know, it's kind of like going on a really bad date, you know? Like you go to somebody's house and like you get your gear all plugged in and you like start playing. And within the first 30 seconds, it's clear that it's like not a fit. But in order, it wouldn't be socially appropriate to just immediately leave. And so you have to stay there for like 2 hours and just suffer. But I was having a really hard time, and I ended up meeting at a bar. I met the guys from And You Will Know Us by the Trail of Dead. And I asked them, like, so how did you guys find the people who you played in a band with together? And they're like, oh, just like our friends. I'm like, oh, friends. I don't have any of those because I moved to Austin by myself, not knowing anybody. Plus, I'm an awful, unlikable person, and that's why I don't have any friends. But that was a what's that?
I was gonna say, like, if I can follow up on that real quick too. The you know, it's interesting. You mentioned the whole that scenario. Like, imagine if you had job interviews where you're showing up in someone's living room and like, or it's a weird thing. Like, we, you know, like, I've definitely had those scenarios where you show up somewhere and you're like, oh, maybe I joined bands that way, where it'd be in someone's house or something, their living room, like, literally. And then, but when I, one of the things I did, I think that it was actually helpful for me when I was starting the band, like the current band, the Mighty Missoula, was at some point I was like, I'm going to make a commitment to renting a practice space so that I can have people come to me. And so I know that, you know, we have a period of time and then they have to leave. And like, it's like, this is my space and I'm hoping to fill out a band that we're going to use this, you know, practice space. And so, so then it ended up being a thing where, like, I eventually met a drummer that I liked, that I resonated with. And then she just left her drum kit there. And I was like, cool. And so that worked out really well. But we always knew, I think it was a good tactic, but it meant that I had to spend some extra money myself because I didn't have a band to share the cost of, say, a practice rehearsal space together with for a couple months. But that, I feel like, provided some legitimacy to my project in a weird way. So I don't know where I'm trying to go with that, outside of, like, that might be something. If you're trying to find a starter band, have a neutral place that people can meet up, that also, if you're worried about them being kind of weird in the long run, then you can at least know that they don't know where you live. So that would be helpful.
There you go. All right. Well, I'm glad this podcast could be like half programming stuff, half music stuff. Dear listener, I hope you enjoyed it. Robbie, do you want to leave us with where people can find you online, that stuff?
Yeah. So you can find me on most of the socials. I'm Robbie with a Y, Russell, and you can find my company at planetargon.com.
Robbie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Jason.